major far-off communities. 2 years earlier, we'd lost every game by 10 runs or more. With only 30 kids in the town league and 3 weeks to practice, my two fellow coaches and I couldn't afford to be choosy. Our roster of 12 thus included a small core of solid players and a generous helping of younger players who were relatively new to the sport. Sam, who played outfield and first base, had a swing that resembled a person fighting off a Wolverine. Ginn, who preferred wearing a stocking hat to a baseball cap, wasn't too sure about some of the rules, like whether a base runner should run on a fly ball. Several others were wary of the ball, for good reason, since Ben was sporting 2 black eyes and a broken nose, a souvenir from an ill-advised game of 3-way catch. At the first practice, as the players warmed up by playing catch, the other coaches and I posed a challenge. Could every pair make 10 good throws and catches without dropping or overthrowing the ball? After 15 minutes, we decided it'd be best to move on to another drill. There was, as the saying goes, only one thing to do. Like Mike Feinberg and Dave Levin at KIPP, I followed the Butch Cassidy method. For the next 3 weeks, I stole ideas from the people and places I'd been visiting over the past year, and with the other coaches, applied them to our team. Like the music teachers at Meadowmount, we taught hitting by slowing the swings down, working on a tee, and having the players watch and imitate good swings over and over. Like John Wooden or Linda Septian, we tried to teach with quick, informative GPS-style bursts. In my previous years of coaching, I'd always coached the group as a whole, teaching one way for everyone. Now I tried to target each player, finding ways to connect, and when they did something correctly, stopping them and telling them to remember that feeling. Like the Brazilian futsal players, we found ways to compress and speed up the game. We pitched batting practice from 30 feet away instead of 45, forcing our hitters to react more quickly. Like Tom Martinez, we taught defensive positioning by laying out a miniature baseball field and isolating the mental element of the game. Who covers first on a bunt? Who has the cutoff to a play at home? I shamelessly channeled Martinez-isms. Finish the throw. Take pride in your swing. See how easy it isn't? When the day came, we rented an RV and drove north to Kenai, host city, for the 4-day-long tournament. We set up a campsite at the ball field and quickly assembled our secret weapons. The lucky polar bear doll, the salmon pregame meal, and the assortment of rubber bands and braids my daughters used to lend the team its distinctive Bjork-like hairstyles. We felt prepared. But when our first opponent, Kodiak, trotted smoothly onto the field, our team suddenly looked twitchy and nervous. So did their parents in the stands, some of whom had witnessed last year's contest versus Kodiak, in which we'd been thumped 15-1. Kodiak whipped through a well-choreographed warm-up routine. We watched in silence. "They're good," Ben said in awe. As if to prove it, Kodiak's leadoff hitter opened the game by laying down a perfect bunt that rolled softly down the third baseline, a sure hit. But it wasn't. Brian, our third baseman, charged, scooped the ball with his bare hand, and whipped it to first, where Johan, the second baseman, was waiting to make the out, just like we'd practiced. We held them scoreless for 3 innings, then scored 2 runs on a pair of hard-hit balls to take the lead. Kodiak replied with 4 runs, and then we came back when Brian, to his astonishment, as well as ours, whacked an Andrew Jones-worthy home run over the left field fence. It was a tight, thrilling, well-played game that ended just short of a win. Nevertheless, the team walked back to the campsite shocked and happy at what we'd done. We felt the strange thrill of the HSE. As one of the parents said, "It's like a miracle." It would be nice to say that we miraculously won the tournament. We didn't. We played well, winning 1 and losing 2 more heart-stoppingly close games, 1 in extra innings. Each game was studded with revelatory moments. Ginn ripping a single, Aiden pitching shutout ball, Ben making fearless catches, and Sam, the ex-Wolverine fighter, hitting a home run. And when the last game was over and the campsite was taken down, a few members of the team were still on the field playing pickup games in their uniforms. They would have played all night. When I started working on this project, I came across an electron microscope photo of myelin. It's not a great image in the usual sense of the word. It's grainy and blurred. but I like looking at it, because you can see each individual wrap, like the layers in a cliff face or the growth rings of a tree. Each wrap of myelin is a unique tracing of some past event. Perhaps that wrap was caused by a coach's pointer. Perhaps that one by a parent's encouraging glance. Perhaps that one by hearing a song they loved. In the whorls of myelin resides a person's secret history, the flow of interactions and influences that make up a life, the Christmas lights that, for some reason, lit up. At home, I find myself picturing these strings of light sometimes, flickering and flashing as our family plays games, gets lost in books, or talks around the dinner table. It seems utterly impossible that these little people will soon be grown up, doing unthinkably complicated and marvelous things. But it's not. It will happen. After all, we are myelin beings. The other day, our daughter Zoe picked up her violin and stumbled her way through a new song about a fat king and queen who had a dog. She stopped frequently. She made mistakes. She started over. It sounded choppy, and it sounded wonderful. "I'm going to practice it a zillion million times," she said. "I'm going to play super good."
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.